because ethics really about is about non-harming. So this is what we have to run past ourselves when we're going to do an action, particularly if there's some grey areas. So sometimes it's very obvious about ethical behaviour, but there's also grey areas. And I posed at the conference a few ethical questions. I'm going to do one tonight, which is not directly related to love and relationships, but it's a question that I came across when I was quite young, 1978, and it was an ethical question, and it's more about pointing the direction of how we deal with a situation when it's in a grey area. And I'm going to throw this question at you, and I'm actually going to go around and ask people what they would do, all right? Because I just want to kind of set the tone that it's not so... The black and white's really obvious. It's the grey areas where we struggle. And that's what we're going to be talking a bit tonight about, the grey areas. So, okay, so this was the question I put on Saturday. If you come across... And someone, I might have done this once before, so some of you may know the answer that came up, but... You come across, you're walking along, and you come across a spider's web, and an ant has just been caught in the spider's web. What do you do? Do you step away, because that's nature? Do you interfere? What do you do? Come on, give me some answers. What would you do? You'd look at it, right? You'd look at it. Okay, that's an answer. All right, anyone else?
I've always helped, but recently I've stopped.
Okay, you'd help, but recently you've stopped. Why have you stopped?
Because I felt sorry for the spider.
Felt sorry for the spider, okay. Anyone else?
I would just step right over.
You'd what?
I would step right over.
Keep out of the road, okay. Yeah. Okay, anyone else? Depends on your mood. Okay, so that's a reasonable answer. Someone else has said that. What? Anyone else? Would there be anyone here that saves the ant? You've always done so, but you've stopped. Okay. So you're making a logical decision. Okay. So this is this. At least there's. Yeah. Okay. So I was given this question in 1978 by a young monk, and I thought about it, and I thought, I don't know, well, it seems to be nature, and I mean, so anyway, he gave me a great answer, and I just loved it, and I do want to share it with you. He said, the moment you come across the ant and the spider, you've become part of the equation, all right? You are no longer outside the situation. You've observed it, you've seen it. And he said, think about it logically. And I love the way he dissected this. He's now a teacher and has opened a very big centre in Perth for the Tibetan Buddhist Society and a huge Tibetan temple. Amazing teacher. And he was 19 at the time, and he was amazing then. And he said, you're part of the equation. He said, now think about it logically. If you remove the ant and let it go on its way, you've saved the ant's life. Will the spider die if he misses out on lunch? No. He'll be better for it. Yeah, you go on a fast and he'll be healthy. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of animals that get caught in spiders' webs and they get away, but the spider still survives. And as you say, there's a lot of things strung up in his web. So he said, once you're part of the equation, you have to sometimes make a decision. Now, a lot of people say, oh, it's nature, I won't interfere, but okay, if the ant was completely wrapped up and you couldn't say that that's the way it is, but I like the answer that all of a sudden you become part of an equation. And when you're part of an equation, you then become, in a sense, responsible for your actions. You're not responsible for the spider's actions or the ant's, but you can do something about it. I had a very interesting ethical situation today. I went and bought some coriander at the markets, and there was bunches of coriander and one with a snail on it. And I went, ah, well, I've got to save the snail, haven't I? Because if I leave the snail, then someone's just going to pick it off and squash it. It's a little snail. And if I take the bunch with the coriander, I can then take the snail off at a later date and put it on a nice juicy bush, which is what I did. And even as I handed the bunch of coriander to the girl, the cashier, I just turned it so she didn't see the snail, because I thought she'd go, oh! So I saved the snail. I was very happy about that. And these are the grey areas of ethics that we come across. What do you do when you're there? What do you do when you get 20 cents too much in your change? And this is about relationships, because in a sense, someone has, you're in a shop, it's their shop, they give you 20 cents too much. And you've walked out of the shop and you realise 10 minutes later, what do? You go, ah. Where do you go back? Well, come on.
I wouldn't go back if it was 20 cents, it was like an hour later.
It was an hour later.
Yeah.
Interesting, isn't it? This happened to me. I was actually probably 15, 20 minutes down the road from the post office, and I had this 20 cents. I went, hold it, that gave me too much. But you know what? I actually walked back, and I gave the money back to the worker behind the post office, so it wasn't just a personal shop. And she went, you're kidding. Because she'd known I'd been there 10 minutes ago. I said, I don't want it to be my problem. It's immaterial, the amount of money, but I don't want it to be my problem. Because otherwise, I'd be still thinking about it. You know, it's that classic example of, you've heard of the two monks that come to the riverside, and there's an old woman on the side of the river, and one monk scoops her up and carries her across, and a mile, a kilometre further on, the older monk turns and says, you know, we're not allowed to touch women, and particularly carry them across the river. And he said, well, I put her down on the other side and you're still carrying her. And that's what ethical problems cause us. See, when we become, when we knowingly do something wrong, or something happens and we knowingly not correct it, we then have a degree of agitation. We have a problem with dealing with our emotions over that thing. You know, someone said, to be a very good liar, you have to have an amazing memory. I knew a guy once that masqueraded as a lawyer to a whole range of people for about 12 months. And he was even doing, he had done a year of law, but he pretended that he'd finished. And so he manufactured his life in a way that he gave this illusion that he was a lawyer. And he actually was very bright, and he knew a lot of legal terms, and he even knew about contracts and things, but he never finished his degree. And when it came undone, the backlash in everything that he did was really quite sad. He almost got to the point of committing suicide from the shame that he had, because he not only fooled a small number of people, he fooled a lot of number of people. And he caught, and in the end, from all those people that knew him, he never saw them again, because he was too ashamed. Now, for the people, it didn't matter whether he was a lawyer or not. Right? Who cares? Doesn't matter. He can be anybody. But they actually did lie. He was quite charismatic. But because of his lack of self-esteem, he thought he wouldn't be accepted by these people unless he had a degree. And so therefore he manufactured this situation in his life, which caused him terrible suffering. Terrible suffering. And he had to go and admit and apologise to everyone that he was not that. And yet, in the end, he stepped away from everyone. And it was difficult for a lot of people, because they'd taken his word. And so what happened then is that when that happens, you then question everything the person has ever said to you. Have you ever been in that situation where someone hasn't told you the truth, and then all of a sudden, how can you believe them? very difficult. So in relationships, it's about how we're dealing with other people. What is the degree of honesty that we have with other people? So that's about lying, okay? So, and that's just one of the issues. Has anyone got anything to say about that? Any experience they've had? Has anyone ever come across a pathological liar? Someone that just can't tell the truth? You have? What was it like?
Bizarre.
It was bizarre. So that... How can you be friends with someone when you know that every second thing they're going to say may not be the truth? Yeah. Yeah. That's right. What do you do? It's very hard in those situations. I mean, it's very natural to say an untruth. I was massaging this woman one time at her house and the phone rang. And she said, "Quick, answer the phone and tell them I'm not home." And I said, "And will I tell them I'm the burglar, will I?" She seemed to be embarrassed that she was getting a massage or something. And so she said, "Quick, lie for me. Tell them I'm not home." And I said, "Well, I can't do that. You're lying right here." So I said, we've got a choice, right? I said, you're not home and we don't answer the phone, so we don't answer the phone and therefore we don't answer the phone, so it just rings through because you're busy. I pick up the phone and say, "Look, I'm sorry, she's busy, call you later," but I'm not going to lie. The third option is not part of something I'm going to do. And she said, "Oh, let's not answer it." So that was fine. You know, my teacher, occasionally I've asked him a question and he said, "I'm not telling you." There you go. He didn't lie. I said, "Oh, could you tell me the answer to that?" He said, "No." We often don't think of that option, do we? "I'm just not going to tell you." "Oh, okay. Well, there you go." No more. So these are the things that we come up against in those situations. Did you have a... No, no. You were just moving your hand. Okay.
No question,
just waving. Yeah, so that's one of the areas, and really telling the truth is, it does become a big problem. Another person once rang me up on the phone and they said, "I'm going to tell you this, but if so-and-so rings you and asks you if I've told you, then you have to say, no, I haven't told you." I said, "I'm not going to do that." "Isn't it interesting? They want you to lie for them." I said, "No, I'm not going to do that." She said, "Well, what are you going to do?" I said, "Well, I can say that I've heard the story, but I'm not going to tell you. I can say that to them. But I'm not going to say I've never heard, because that's a lie." And she went, "Oh, maybe I won't tell you." I said, "There's a good choice." Then we don't have a problem. And it's not being unkind to people. There are grey areas. A classic example, when I came across Buddhism, you're actually allowed to break a vow to save someone's life. So there's a rabbit being chased by the hunters. The rabbit goes that way and the hunters arrive and they say, "Which way?" And you go, "I haven't seen it." Now that's a deliberate lie, but you're saving the life of an animal. So yes, there'll be some karmic backlash for the lie, obviously, cause and effect, but the greater good is that you've actually saved the animal's life. So there are certain ways of doing it. Okay. There's another situation, again it's a scriptural situation of ethics, and again telling the truth, and we'll go on to the various other ethical questions too, but someone is dying and they're terribly fearful of death and they say to you, "Am I dying?" But you know if you tell them, it's going to really, really freak them out. So what do you do?
I think it's actually better to start just to let him know when he's going to die, so that he can have the emotional preparation.
Yeah, but what if they're not prepared to emotionally... See, yeah, this is fine. Buddhists do prepare themselves for death. There's a lot of people in the community that don't. Okay? Buddhists talk a lot about death and preparing ones for death and for rebirth. There are people out there that are absolutely terrified. In fact, there was a quote from an archbishop once many years ago, and these profound dying words were, "I'm so scared." Seems a bit sad really for an archbishop, but there is a way, and I've actually heard this question answered. You could say to the person, "Oh look, we're doing everything we can at the moment." You know, just not shoving it up. You have to know the quality of the person. Now, if I'm dying and I'm a Buddhist, I really want to know so I can prepare, absolutely. You know? And in fact, a friend of mine years ago died of leukemia. And within the Tibetan Book of the Dead, there's a whole series of dissolution of elements that one sees as visions when one's dying. And he was so fascinated by this. He was telling my teacher, he said, "You know that bit in the book where you see..." He said, "I'm seeing it now. It's happening." And he was right into it. So to tell him he wasn't dying would have been a terrible injustice. And he even told us on the phone before he died, he said, "Well..." He said, "I'm going to be going into a coma in about 4 hours' time, 5 hours' time, and then I'll be in that coma for about this." He said he'd gone through the whole thing. But he was so clear about his practice and so confident that it wasn't a drama. And apparently the nurses were just completely stunned that this guy was so absolutely okay. And I'll give you a little bit of advice that his teacher gave him. He said, and I think this is wonderful actually, he said, "Look towards your new rebirth as though you're a child for the first time going to the seaside." He said, "Have that kind of enthusiasm." And that's an interesting way of looking at it. Instead of seeing it as a tragedy, a Buddhist could see it as an opportunity for an incredibly good rebirth with a better body that wasn't dying. So, you know, there's a way of looking at it. But again, it's like being at the coalface. You can't make the decision until you're there. You really can't make the decision. And sometimes you'll make the wrong decision. You'll say, "Oh, I really wish I hadn't said that." But that's how we develop our wisdom. Wisdom comes from good judgment. Good judgment comes from bad judgment. Sadly, we learn by our mistakes, hopefully. Sadly, we have mistakes, but hopefully the positive is that we actually learn from them. So it's only when we're actually up against something that we really then know how to deal with it. But firstly, we have to train in our understanding of that. We have to test ourselves out. Any questions so far? No? Okay. If you have any ethical problems that you've come up against, please, you know, we'll discuss them, because if there's any issues we need to talk about, that's good. We can kind of work with it here. Idle gossip. Gossip. That's a great one. How does gossip affect relationships? And what's the motivation behind gossip? Actually, we'll do that first. What do you reckon the motivation is behind gossip? Sorry?
Entertainment.
Okay, that's one comment. What do you think the other ones are?
Security.
Insecurity, yep. In what way would you say that?
Well, I guess people like to draw attention away from themselves. They're insecure.
Yeah.
They gossip about other things.
Yeah, that's right. That's quite... this lack of self-esteem. That's pretty much on the money, apart from entertainment, which, you know, all the tabloids. But it's almost like, generally when we gossip, and I'm talking more about malicious gossip, really, where we're talking about someone. You know, did you know that? When we do that, what are we doing for ourselves? We think we're doing for ourselves, the other person, elevating ourselves. We wouldn't do that. We're better than that. We wouldn't do that. And we become superior. We try to make ourselves superior because, probably, as you put it, we feel insecure. And if we feel insecure, we try to build ourselves up. So we try to pick ourselves up and talk about the other person. And generally, that kind of gossip will tend to put the other person down.
You're also harming yourself when you do that.
Ah, absolutely. You're causing yourself a lot of problems. In fact, you're creating the karmic cause to be gossiped about yourself. That's what happens. And so you can look at that and realise, okay, you may comment. I mean, often here I'll talk about situations, okay, about people that I've heard about, but you won't ever hear me give you their names, okay? Because I'm doing it as an instruction, but I'm not doing it to harm them. Because if I start giving names and then you start thinking negatively about that person, I've harmed their reputation and caused you to think negatively about somebody else, when in fact I may actually be completely wrong in my judgment. Did you know they did this? And gossip is incredibly infectious and in how it gets out of control. You look at all the tabloids now that we have, all the Newsweeks and Good Ideas and Bad Ideas, and you know, and we have stacks of them, and people are reading this gossip about film stars when 99% of it isn't true. I mean, how many times has Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt broken up? I mean, you know, 400 times. That is an exaggeration, but you know, constantly there's this news getting out, and these people just make up news. And in fact, I heard a story one time on radio where this radio announcer was talking to a journalist who had said, I read your story about this guy being kicked to death in Oxford Street in front of a club. And the guy said, yeah. He said, I actually found out the real story. The guy was having an epileptic fit, and these two guys were bending over him trying to help him. And he went, yeah, that was the truth. And he said, well, why did you print that? He said, well, it was a good story. He said, well, why didn't you retract it? He said, well, what's the point? No one's interested. Isn't that incredible? An absolute blatant lie by the paper about something which, and unfortunately the guy did die, had an epileptic fit and died, but they decided to beef it up a bit because that wasn't interesting. You know, in fact, unfortunately, the media causes a lot of problems. You know, a lot of problems. Yep.
That's because when people are interested in
stuff, that's right. That's right. Yeah, we drive the media, absolutely. We drive the media because we're interested in about listening to someone else's suffering because it's not us. Oh, thank goodness. It didn't happen to me, but we're fascinated by bad news for some reason. Fascinated by it, but we don't have to buy into it. You know, we don't have. Do you remember the O.J. Simpson trial? Do you remember that in America? O.J. Simpson was a footballer and a film star, and he was said to have murdered his wife. And the whole of America was in on the trial. They televised it. Every moment of everyone's day seemed to be in America and Australia too for a bit, that everyone was focused on the trial of this guy. You know, is he, didn't he, will he go to jail, will he hang? I mean, just amazing. It was like these ghouls hanging on the fence waiting for something to happen. And this is where society starts to break down, when we have this kind of attitude. But we don't have to follow it. We don't have to buy into it. And the more we pollute our minds with that stuff, the more uncomfortable we are, actually. Really, you know, this sense of contentment is really important. There was one thing on Saturday, there was a wonderful Thai nun, and she was asked about happiness. Do you remember that question? Were you the question and answer?
Yeah.
What a wonderful answer. And her answer was that someone said, oh, there's a lot of talk about happiness, what is happiness? And she said, I'm paraphrasing, I won't get it right, but she said, if I can go through a whole day and look back on my day and recognise that I've had virtuous thoughts, virtuous speech and virtuous actions, then I'm very happy. That is a very happy day for me. Imagine saying, well, I lied to 10 people, I ripped off the post office, and I hit somebody. You know, imagine the opposite of that. Oh, and I had a really good day. You know, do you understand? Just having virtuous thought all day, that's a really big one. You know, the person that just, what's that go away? you know, driving in traffic, someone cuts you off immediately. Frustration. So don't answer it. And don't text. I'm watching. So it's about looking at our mind and what we're dealing with, and unfortunately the virtuous thought is difficult. Virtuous action, not so bad. You know, we can go through a day without damaging somebody, hopefully. We can even, if we're lucky, go through a day without saying something negative, if we're very clever. But very difficult to go through a day with just virtuous thought. You know, there's a lot of people out there that can give you the irrits. You know, they just come out of the woodwork. Just when you think you're doing okay, something will happen and frustration will come up. But that doesn't mean that we can't train in that. That doesn't mean that we can't work with that. And that's ethical behaviour, how we're thinking and treating other people. Are we harming them with our thought, deeds or action? And if we start to focus on that, and the more you focus on it, the more mindful we become, and actually the happier we become. Because anyone that starts committing negative actions becomes very agitated. You know, I really don't think people in the mafia ever have a relaxed life. You know, they really don't. They're always looking over their shoulders, waiting for something bad to happen. And so, the more we act positively, the more we free ourselves from samsara. The more we create positive action, the less trouble we're going to have in the future. Basic law of karma. The more we do a negative action, the more we bind ourselves to the wheel of rebirth and karma. So, in a sense, Buddhism is really easy. Find out which is going to cause you suffering and others suffering, and don't do that. Find out which is going to cause yourself and others happiness, and do that. There's Buddhism. Complete. You can get enlightened by doing that. You can end up in negative rebirth by doing the other one. So you just have to work it out. But as I said, there's grey areas. Grey areas. Okay. Covetousness. What's that mean? Covetousness. Covetousness. Wanting something that other people have. Oh, if only I had that money. If only. I heard of a terribly sad situation today. Actually, it was my ex-wife from Queensland rang me, and she said, oh, someone she knew, this girl had, what'd she have? Oh, quite a difficult debilitating disease. She was very thin, she wasn't well, she had diabetes, she was 26 years of age. Cystic fibrosis she had. Difficult disease of the lungs, and she had gone about systematically pretending that she'd had a baby to get welfare. So there she was in a very difficult situation, probably emotionally as well, physically very unwell, and she'd gone about trying to defraud the government to get extra money, and they ended up putting her in jail, which is also very sad. And my ex-wife said she was a really nice person, but she thought that she could get a bit of extra happiness with another $10,000. And that's the sad thing. Not only did she lose the money, she lost the respect of people around her, maybe got a lot of pity, but ended up in jail. So, you know, behaviour like that is very sad. And there are people out there that, you know, in difficult situations, you can kind of almost understand it. But the gaining of money, coveting someone else's possessions or even another person, doesn't bring you happiness. And there's a great story of someone I knew who used to come to the Buddhist Centre, and I really like this story, and I'm sure he wouldn't mind me sharing it with you. He grew up in a suburb where he said they were the poorest family in the suburb. They had very, very little money. And he said up the road were the Smiths. And the Smiths had a really big house. They had lots of money. They had new bikes. They had new holidays. And he said, our whole family really disliked the Smiths. They were absolutely... Whose phone is that? Stop the phones! Okay, so there were the Smiths up the road, and he felt very, very, very... not angry, but really kind of jealous. Really wanted what the Smiths had, and because they didn't have it, the whole family disliked these people. Now, he said, we never knew them. We never spoke to them. Why would you want to speak to people like that? They had money. And this guy was telling us his story at 55 years of age. And we were talking about coveting other things and jealousy. And does anyone know the antidote to jealousy? Generosity, exactly. Wishing the other person well. So we had this talk, and then he came back next week and he said, I drove to my old suburb. I sat in my car outside where the Smith's house would have been. He said they obviously wouldn't be there these days. And he said, I sat there rejoicing in their good fortune for a whole hour. And he said, I drove away feeling so free. I was no longer carrying that burden of jealousy. And he said, I didn't know it was there until it came up in the conversation, but he said, I carried it for years, 50 odd years or so, to carry that burden of just an attitude. So if you ever have the opportunity of going through your attitudes and looking at them, you might want to free yourself of a few of them. Because it's wonderful when you can get that off your shoulders. When you don't, and the poor Smiths, I mean, there they were enjoying their good fortune. But you know, if you've ever lived in life, that no one ever has 100% good fortune. It doesn't matter how much money you have. There's not 100% good fortune. Has anyone ever come across anyone that's got 100% good fortune? Doesn't happen, does it? So it doesn't matter how much money you have or how little you have. You will have good times and you will have bad times. And the Buddha Dharma is about dealing with this stuff. It's not about getting rid of it, in a sense. In a sense, getting enlightened or reaching nirvana is getting rid of it. But we have to also do the journey. And the journey is about how we deal with the stuff when it arrives. And that's also about ethics in our relationships. How do we deal with it when it arrives? How do we deal with someone when they've blatantly lied to us? What do you do? Come on. If you can, yeah. What happens if they do it constantly? You can forgive them to a point, but then sometimes you might also have to walk away from the relationship if it becomes damaging. This is where you've got to use your wisdom. You can't just say, look, I knew of someone in a very difficult situation with a not so good husband. And she said, oh, she's not a Buddhist, but she said, isn't the Buddhist way that you just give everything to them? And I said, well, they're treating you very badly. They're cheating on you. They're doing a whole lot of horrible things. Why would you condone that behaviour?
You're contributing
to it. Allowing them to they're allowing it, yeah. Exactly. And you are allowed to say, if you continue that behaviour, I'm not going to stay. That may be a very good thing for that person to realise that they can't move any further. We know as Buddhists that karma will get us, but a lot of people don't believe in karma. They think karma is when you get caught. Okay? I got away with it, so I didn't get the karma. You know? So it's really about recognizing the situation and dealing with it in a skillful measure. And this is the grey area. So you're allowed, in fact, I was talking with someone once a while ago. His husband was drinking a lot. And she said, I don't know what to do. And I said, well, draw a line in the sand. She said he gets abusive and he's angry when he drinks a lot. And I said, well, that shouldn't be in your life. why don't you just say, if you continue to do this, I won't be here. And she did. And he stopped drinking. He decided that the relationship was more important than his drinking. So he did something about it. Very simple. But if he picks up, if he starts drinking again, she'll walk away. Because you, in a sense, you have to also be responsible to yourself too. Buddhism isn't about just lying down and just giving everything to everybody and say, walk over me and I'm passive and therefore I won't do anything about it. It's about being really, really clear and decisive and using your wisdom and compassion together. This is why we have a moon cushion and a sun cushion under the Buddha. We have compassion and wisdom. We've talked about here about idiot compassion, haven't we? Haven't I ever mentioned that? That's when you take little old ladies across the road when they don't want to go. Because you've decided that you take little old ladies across the road. And halfway across they're hitting you with an umbrella saying, I don't want to go. And you go, no, I'm being compassionate. And I told that story once and someone said, yeah, that did happen to me. I'm taking a little old lady across the road and she's like, I want to go. So that's called idiot compassion. And if you have wisdom without compassion, you have no action at all. You just have this head of knowledge that has no action. So this is where we bring in this idea of ethics. How are we behaving towards others? And honestly, we have so many opportunities of perfecting our ethics because we've always got people around us. We've always got beings around us at all times, and so therefore we have an incredible opportunity to work with it, to develop our patience. Patience is probably the best virtue that you can have when you work with other humans. And you've heard the story about a teacher and his cook, haven't you? Have you heard that story? No, okay. There's a very famous teacher called the teacher who came to Tibet, and he was brought from Nalanda University in India. And he really did a huge reformation of the doctrine in Tibet. He was a new Kadampa master, and he really created a new wave of understanding, as many teachers did at various times coming through Tibet. Anyway, one of the Tibetans came to him and they said, look, Atisha, you're an amazing teacher. We really revere you. You're fantastic, but we just have to have a bit of a word to you about your cook. He's really obnoxious. He's abusive. He doesn't smell good, and he doesn't cook very well either. We will give you anybody. We'll give you 10 cooks to look after you. But just, you know, we really suggest you get rid of him. He's not good for you. And Atisha went, whoa, stop. He said, he's my practice of patience. Without him, I will never develop patience. He's a very difficult person. And he's the person I revere the most. Because that's the person I can work with the most. And that's one of the things I love about Buddhism, is looking at a disastrous situation and turning it to your advantage. Turning all the negatives into the path to enlightenment. And so if you have someone that's really irritating you, you may decide that you might practice patience and really consciously decide to work with that. Yep. That's right, that's right, and you can use it as self-introspection. That's correct. You can see what the reason is. Why is that person pushing your buttons? If you, I guarantee you this will work. If you want to upset a mother, walk up to a mother with a baby and say, I think you're a really terrible mother. Absolutely terrible. If you walk up to the same mother and say, I think you're a really terrible airline pilot, I couldn't care less. You know, we've all got buttons. One great teacher, Sogyal Rinpoche, said, and he was probably one of the best button-pushing lamas I've ever seen. And I'll tell you a story about what he did do once. But he said in a lecture, at a course with about 200 people, he said, don't you understand, people? I'm pushing your buttons. And he said, I'll keep pushing them until you no longer care. He said, this is what opens your minds up. In other words, he quite obviously sometimes would do what they call in Tibetan Buddhism crazy wisdom. But he'd only do it for people to see things. And there was a classic example for me. I was at this retreat, and it had been a long retreat. It was the end of the retreat, been 10 days. We had it in a beach area up in the north coast. And it had just finished. It was about 2 o'clock, and I thought, oh, I can finally get to the beach. Oh, this is great. I had this full visual of just floating in the water. You know, it was a beautiful day. And I'm walking down this bush track away from the camp a bit, and out of the blue comes Soga Rinpoche. And I've never seen him on this track before. He takes one look at me, said, you can help me all afternoon. You're coming to help me undo the shrine. Mm-hmm. And I went, oh, no. He said, have you got anything to do? I went, nah. Nah. You know, there's a holy teacher says, you're going to help. So I go down to the shrine room, and he says, pack that bag. Quite roughly. So I pack it. He said, what did you do it that way for? I said, because it fitted. And he said, you're correct. And I'm thinking, oh, okay. So anyway, there was this table with all these holy relics that he carries with him in suitcases of them. And he says to this girl standing on the other side of the table, he said, whatever you do, don't put your hand across the relics. And I was standing just there. And she goes, yes. He said, give me that. And she goes, and then she goes, oh. And I started to, because it was just so obvious. And he looked at me and said, you can go home now. He got rid of me because I could see what he was doing, and it was very skillful. Anyway, I said to her later, did you see me laugh? She went, no, I was too terrified. But he was just practicing her mindfulness. He'd said her 2 minutes before, do not hand anything across this table, and then said, give me that. And immediately he caught her. Now that was a great lesson for her. She would have got that. You know? And that's about looking at our behaviour, and that's what really ethics is about, looking at our behaviour and how we're reacting to situations. And if we have patience with situations, we don't react with anger, because patience is the antidote to anger. Not love, but patience is the antidote to anger. Having that small amount of time before we react. And all the time that we're reacting to things, it's about ego grasping. I'm going to throw this at you. We can't be angry with someone unless we see ourselves as superior. Is that a reasonable statement? Think about, just go back in situations where you've been angry with someone. Probably driving a car is a good example. Think about it. You have to elevate yourself. How dare you do that? All those terminology, that condescending way. You know, I'm talking about anger. I'm not talking about the recognition of injustice here. Okay, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about being angry with someone. You're angry with someone because they've acted in a way that you never would, which is probably rubbish. Because we've all blown it.
We're all angry with someone. So, because we know we're capable of that, and that's what keeps us off.
Exactly.
You know, it mirrors.
Exactly.
Like,
that's right, and we nail them for it. Yeah. Exactly. We don't like seeing it in ourselves. We're aware of it in ourselves, and then we point our finger at someone else. It kind of throws it the other direction, and we get annoyed. And yes, we do get angry with ourselves. And this is all actually. I'm glad you brought that up. We have to look at ourselves dispassionately. There's no point trying to bury our negative qualities by going, no, not me. I never do that. It's more important to actually look at them but not feel guilty about them. It's when you do a negative action that you can have intelligent regret about the action, not guilt. Yeah? Okay. Well, that's a good point. Situation where you get angry at people when you don't understand. Well,
why are they doing what
they're doing? Yeah. Well, I saw it last night. I was driving home from the Buddhist Centre, and these two guys were racing with P plates on, way over the speed limit. And I just went, "Oh, idiots!" You know. And I wasn't angry, but it was. Why you do it? And I thought, geez, I used to do a bit of that when I was really young, you know? And I thought, oh dear, don't they realise they could kill themselves? And I thought, no, they actually don't realise that. That's not something that they're thinking about at this moment. They're thinking about having fun with their cars, weaving in and out of the traffic. And yes, it is hard, isn't it? And you can look at those motivations, but it is hard when you see some, or when someone's cruel to somebody. Unfortunately, that's what the primordial ignorance is. When we have, you know, in Buddhism we don't have original sin like in Christian, but we do have original ignorance. We don't actually see the way things fit together. And this is why it's important for us to develop our wisdom constantly and develop our mindfulness so that we don't keep walking down those tracks. But I agree, it is hard when we don't understand people's motives. But you can almost guarantee if it's a negative action, it's a motive based on self-grasping. You know, like, can you give me an example of something, maybe?
I'm trying to think. It's just like a feeling that I have with that sort.
Yeah. When someone acts thoughtlessly, or...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And that's the point, they act thoughtlessly.
Differently.
Yeah,
just like if I don't understand what the
and it is hard, and that's where we need to develop our wisdom too, so that we don't act thoughtlessly. You know, there's always a degree at which we can look at those situations, but someone else could look at us and go, "Well, why that? Why did you do it that way?" So we have to have this self-introspection. It's not about beating ourselves up. That's really not beneficial either. That just lowers your self-esteem and you feel like there's no hope. It's about developing self-esteem, but also developing really, really clear self-awareness on how we're reacting to people. And also taking the time to just actually smile at people, create relationships with people. You know? There was, I was in a supermarket tonight, this afternoon, and there was this cashier that was really worked really hard, and there was lots of people, and she took the time to smile at everyone. Just that moment she went, "See you later," and it was genuine. I thought, wow, that girl's amazing. You know, she genuinely was doing it. Maybe the boss had, but you know, that's someone I'd want on my cashier, you know, serving customers, if I had someone there to just take that amount of time. And that doesn't take a big effort. And not only that, it also makes you feel good. If you take the time to be, in a sense, that's a generosity, isn't it? Just generosity of time and positive energy. If you take that amount of time with someone, you then create a great bond and a relationship. See, I remember that. I can remember her face really clearly. If I go to that supermarket again, and I see her again, I'm going to be really interested if she's still keeping it up. It's fascinating. But it was a great lesson for me. Just really, those things are important. My teacher was walking through a supermarket once, and this was told to me by one of the guys that was with him, and they were pushing a trolley. And this little, very little old lady was pushing a trolley, and he just stopped, and he walked over to her, and he just took a hand. She was quite bent over, and just held a hand, and said, "Are you okay?" And she went, "Oh yes, thank you for asking." And he said, my friend was watching, said this woman just literally brightened up, that there was one person in the world that came over, and she may be totally alone, came over and said, "Are you okay?" And those are opportunities that we can have moment by moment, and that's the way we develop good relationships with people. It's interestingly enough, it's the small karmas that we create, not the big ones, that are important. That's where we do our mind training, with the small actions that we actually come across, not the large, grandiose things that we do, but it's the small ones. How do we act when people ring us up on the phone and ask for money or try to sell us something? How do we deal with that? How do you deal with it? You say, I'm not interested yet. What happens if they get in a bit further with it? What do you do? You don't go that far. Yeah. Are you kind to them or are you nasty to them? One guy was rang me up and said to me, I'm wondering if you would do this survey for me. And I said, are you being paid for this? He said, yes. I said, what's my cut? He said, what do you mean? I said, what do I get? And there was this dead silence. And he said, a very nice thank you. And I said, you won me. I'll do your survey. I mean, you can be reasonable. I mean, I was playing with him, and he actually appreciated it. And he was absolutely honest. You know, he didn't kind of squirm out of it. He lifted this little voice said, I'll give you a very nice thank you. And I said, that's great. I really like your attitude. Who knows? What, eating sugar or something. I had no idea what it was about. You know, it didn't matter. But I was very happy to do his survey.
I generally, because I've worked.
Have you? Oh, okay.
I generally, like, I'm nice about it, and I say to them, can you please take me off your list? And I find, like, I reckon if you're nice about it, then they will take you off that list, and then you're not going to get those calls.
Right. Sort of,
being nice is sort of
helping out. I had one guy. I have to get quite stern with this guy. He rang me up from some club and asked I said, yes, I'll donate $50 on my credit card. And when the statement came through, he'd taken 100. So I rang him up and I said, about 2 weeks ago, you made a call to me and you took $100 off instead of 50. And he said, oh, yeah. And I'm thinking, hello. He actually remembers it. I said, well, I actually only donated 50, so that's all I'm donating. Oh, yeah, I'll fix it up. A week went by, hadn't fixed it up. So I rang again. Oh, yeah, well, I thought it had gone through. So I rang again, and finally I said, look, I'm a bit concerned with this. I want you to ring me and tell me exactly when it's gone through. Now, frankly, I could afford to give the $100, no big deal. But there was an ethical point there that when I'd pledged it and he'd gone over the mark and then he hadn't corrected, and then when I asked him to correct it, he hadn't corrected, and then a second time. And believe it or not, 2 months later, the same company rang again and said, oh, can you give money? I said, no, I can't, son. I didn't tell them exactly why, but it was just unbelievable that someone would go down that track. And I said, look, it's really not good behaviour if you're doing this call centre stuff to do actually act in that way. Now, I don't know if it was deliberate. I got a sense that he wanted to get a reasonable tally on his call centre rings, and that was one way of doing it. And I was wondering whether he really actually, and I was nearly going to go and call the corporation and say, look, this isn't great. Is this guy doing this more often? Because if he's starting to put more money on, and a lot of people don't notice, they don't read their statement, or they go, oh, what's it matter, an extra $50, an extra $20. So, you know, something you might actually watch in the future. And that to me is unethical behaviour, and it doesn't create good relationships. If I was him, and I'd made a mistake, I'd say, look, sir, I'm going to fix it immediately. I will ring you and tell you when it's done, and I really apologise. Then no problem. But he didn't do it. So I had to ring him 3 times to get that action. That's when things become unethical, and that's where they damage relationships. And I probably won't give to that charity again. I'll divert money somewhere else because I don't trust them. which is not a good thing. And I may still, at some stage, find out what's going on, because I don't think it's worthwhile. And they're a reasonable charity, but not good. So those are they're the small things that happen, and that we also have to be very clear within ourselves. I could have just said, oh, it doesn't matter, I'll be generous. No, you make a contract with someone, and in a sense, you also have to honour it as well. You have to have ethical behaviour and not let it slide, because I may have prevented that happening to somebody else, which is a good thing. Any other circumstances that happen to anyone? Any other situations? Okay, we're going to jump in here. Sexual misconduct. What's sexual misconduct? It's all about harming someone else. There was a question that a lama was asked once. Is it okay if I have two girlfriends? Said this guy. And the answer from the lama was, as long as your girlfriends are okay with that, no problem. Huh? It's not a hard and fast set of rules that you have to have one partner. You can have as many as you like, as long as the others are quite comfortable with that. And in Tibet, interestingly enough, quite often one wife will marry two or three brothers. It's quite common, not so much these days, but it was in Tibet. Three brothers would marry one woman. I don't know how the women cope, but still. But that was kind of the rule. And one of the reasons for that was so that the farms would not be broken up. So the parents would give their farm to the three brothers, and so that the properties wouldn't be broken up with families, one woman would marry the three of them. And they didn't see that as unethical behaviour. So it wasn't sexual misconduct in that sense. So again, if you look at all ethical behaviour, it's about not harming. If you've got three girlfriends or three boyfriends and they don't know about each other, then that could be, and they find out, that could be quite damaging. And this isn't to go on the, because you're not thinking quite nice, but for some reason, and could you imagine what kind of subterfuge and lying you'd have to do to keep that happening? How much energy and work you'd have to do that? And that's the problem with telling lies, particularly. You know? So there was this idea of grasping, and then maybe this guy found it absolutely interesting to live like, you know, a spy or a KGB or something, but the difficulties in your life when you do that was just beyond me. I couldn't believe it. It's too hard. And so this is the thing. When we act unethically, and we do know that, I mean, sometimes it maybe it's not clear, we do have this level of agitation in our minds. And that level of agitation is very, very uncomfortable. When we know we've created something, when we know we've got the 20 cents we could have given back, and then you carry it. In fact, it was on Saturday someone came up to me and said, basically had that same problem. They'd been given, it was an interesting one, they were working in a company. The company only paid the person half the amount of money during that tax year, and then paid them the next amount, and somehow it got to the situation where she owed the tax department $3,000, but she hadn't declared it because it had been, and in a sense she was justifiably didn't owe the tax department because they should have paid her then. But she said, I'm in a difficult situation. In terms of the situation that was with this company, I shouldn't have paid the extra tax. But because I got the tax then, I should be paying that tax, but I haven't declared it in the next financial year. Okay. So what happened was, she said, I've got this $2,000 that no one will ever know about because I'm not declaring it, but I'm ripping the tax office off. What do I do? And she said, it's been a couple of years now. And I said, well, you're carrying it around. I said, would that money change your lifestyle? Will you not eat? She said, no, but I was sitting there thinking a bit of a holiday. I said, well, okay. I said, here's a way of dealing with it. Go back to the original company, get them to give you a letter saying that they didn't pay you the full amount in that year, and then go to the tax office and say, here you go. I said, because you don't need to carry that around. The fact that you're even coming up to me and asking me about it, an ethical dilemma, means that you're carrying it around. Why do you need to have that burden? Why do you need to have that difficulty? In the end, in 20 years' time, a couple of grand won't mean anything to you anyway. No big deal. If it's a holiday, it'll be just a memory. So why don't you clear the whole thing up instead of having to carry the burden around? Because the burden is bigger than the amount of money. And she agreed with me. She said, yeah, that's a really good idea. It's going to be a bit of effort. I'll have to go back and get a letter from the company. But I think I'll do that. I said, then you're free. You don't have to think about it again. You know, it's like the snail on the coriander today. If I hadn't saved that snail today, I'd be thinking about it now going, I wish I had it. So when we're there, we can make those decisions and we can act quite responsibly in terms of how we act. But we have to think about it and we have to be mindful. And that's the practice of mindfulness. Being present to what's going on. And so in a sense, Buddhism gives us these wonderful tools to be able to work with everything that we've got. With every situation that comes up, there is an answer for it. Yeah? We can work with it. We can train our minds to be mindful through the practice of meditation, and then we can use that mindfulness to act in a balanced way. We don't have to become neurotic with it either. We can just become completely... If you've, as you said, talking about Tenzin Palmai, some of these great practitioners I met on the weekend were unbelievably focused and unbelievably peaceful, relaxed and very funny. Really enjoying their lives by being absolutely present. Not worrying about the future, not worrying about the past. One Western Australian Theravada monk, fabulous guy, I can never remember his name, but he's very funny. He said, you know, if you be patient, it all works out in the long run. It just does work out in the long run. You just have to, you know, just have faith and be patient and act with the best qualities you have at the time, and it does work out in the long run. That's it. Ajahn Brahm, yeah. He said that, didn't he? Yeah. He's fabulous. He's hysterically funny, but really focused, you know. So it's not about being miserable and focused, it's about being enjoying the moment, because that's all we have. And we have this ever-present moment that does this. We don't have a past, we don't have a future, we just have this ever-present 3 seconds that does this. And we spend most of our lives outside that. Worrying about this, worrying about that. Do you realise in 110 years the whole of the world's population will have moved on? 6 billion people will not be alive. The 6 billion people that are alive today will not be alive in 100 years. So I'm saying 110 because they might push the envelope a bit. But isn't that amazing? So whatever you do now in terms of importance, I'm going to qualify this, in terms of importance, it's not very important. Karmically it's very important, but in terms of you worrying about it, it's not that important. Because in 100 years, no one will care. However, if we've acted in a negative way, in an unbalanced way, if we've created negative karma, we sure is going to get it later on. We'll be in the next batch of 6 million. 6 billion, and then the next batch. So all we have is this moment, and in that moment we can act quite perfectly. So we don't have to think about acting ethically in the future or beating ourselves up for not acting ethically in the past. We can regret those actions and not do them again. But all we need to do is focus on this little bit of time right now. And that's endless, actually. That little bit of time has been in our beginningless lives from beginningless time and will continue on for beginningless time. I think that's fantastic. We have infinite time to practice our practice of mindfulness and ethical behaviour. And that, to me, is really, that's a great message. It fills me with hope, because even if I haven't done so well in the past, I've got an opportunity of doing better now. And doing better now then creates more wisdom and clarity in the future. Okay, any questions? Got a little bit of time left. Any thoughts? Yes.
I just want to go back to the scenario where the dad wanted to make it. So the person had an access of $2,000
because of calculation, yeah.
Say if this person eventually decides to donate the money to charity.
Yeah, oh, good point. Okay, so there's this person that things have happened, they've got an excess of money, they donate it to charity. Nice idea, but they haven't cleaned up the mess. We can't be Robin Hood.
Is Robin ethical?
No. Stealing and giving to somebody else is not an ethical behaviour. Alright? Yep.
So I'm just thinking about this tax thing. And I don't think the name was actually believe it, but it's almost ethical to try not to pay tax.
I think it's an interesting point. It's absolutely reasonable to limit your tax bill ethically, honestly, right? Absolutely. You know, if karmically, as we were cheating on the tax department, our bank account was going down at the same rate, we would stop immediately. But unfortunately, there's a gap between cause and effect. And so we think, oh, it's only the tax officer, it doesn't matter. But yes, it's your right as a taxpayer to pay as little tax as possible, and it's the taxation department just gets you to pay as much tax as possible. And somewhere in the between two, there's a balance. But you can't cheat on it, because again, it's unethical behaviour. So to give that money away rather than clean it up. If they say, oh, we don't care, keep it, yeah, sure, it's your money, but it's actually not your money, so it's not your money to give away. That's the problem. And you have to be clear about that. It's not your action. And in fact, it happened to me one time. There was, not with the taxation department, this was the situation, it was a good learning for me. I was working for a company, which was a chronic pain and stress company dealing with chronic pain and stress, and one of the girls had organised a lecture by someone, which was a paying lecture, and I was helping on it, and just at the end of the at the beginning of the lecture, there was a whole lot of free seats up the back, and this woman came up and she said, look, would you mind really much, I really want to see this lecture and I really don't have any money, would it be okay? And I'm seeing all these empty chairs, the lecture's about to start, and I'm like, yeah, just sit in that corner. And the person who was organising came up to me and they said, you just let that woman in free. I said, yeah. She said, you didn't organise this thing and you had a duty to come and ask me if that was okay. And I went, you're right. So in a sense, without really knowing, I was trying to be compassionate and I could see there was not a big drama, but I actually acted without thinking, and I should have gone to her and said, look, this woman hasn't got any money. Do you want to let her in free or not? And it was her call, not mine. And she said, it was my call, not yours. And I said, look, I'm really sorry. So there's a grey area where I went, oh, great. And I really, and that, gosh, that goes back 20 years, 25 years. But I remembered that example. Oh, well, it wasn't my lecture to give away. If it was mine, I would have said, yeah, sure, no problem. But I was trying to be kind without being ethical. Okay? And that was a really good lesson for me. I really got that one. So in future, when a situation comes up, you go to the person and say, look, is it okay if this happens? That then covers the situation. And if they say no, well, then you can't do anything about it. It's not, you haven't set the whole thing up. And that's what I was saying in the beginning when I was talking about the grey areas. Those are the things that are difficult, and they're the things where we have to have wisdom. But, you know, if we do spend a bit of time thinking about it, we will come up with the right answer eventually. We'll trip over a few times, as I have many times in my life, but gradually you start to improve on it. Yep?
You said I'm
going to
ask,
you're
not allowing a woman to get in, and if you get upset, wouldn't it be okay for us to get upset?
Who do you get upset?
So? Like, if we see that there's a lot of anti-terrorism and the organizers did not allow that woman that did not have money to get in to the lecture, of course, like, we would feel upset about it.
Yeah, well, what I did, I offered to pay for her, actually. I actually paid for her. I said, look, I'm really sorry. You're correct. I will actually pay for her ticket. And I wrote a check and paid for the ticket. So I cleaned it up, you know, and the woman said, okay, fair enough, and she took the money, and it was clean. So you can do that. You can fix things up because you've acted incorrectly, and that's where you can go back to the shopkeeper and sort it out. She didn't throw her out. She let her sit there. She didn't cause her any grief, but yeah, it was just a sticky situation that could have been avoided by me having a little bit more clarity. And that's where that's idiot compassion, in a sense, without thinking through the situation, making a choice that it actually wasn't up to me. Yeah. Okay, we've got about 15 minutes. Any other questions that have come up? Yep, another one?
Premarital sex, is that
No, according to Buddhism, premarital sex isn't sexual misconduct. That's a Christian thing. It's not something that Buddhism sees as a particular issue. Again, if it's harming, then it's a problem. If it's not harming, not a problem.
And what if the relationship eventually ends? I mean,
it ends.
Okay.
It ends.
So how do you define sexual misconduct?
Sexual misconduct, anything that harms another person. So if there are two consenting adults that want to live together and not get married, what's the problem?
So the legality is just...
Legality is just a legality. And in fact, de facto relationships are now pretty legal anyway. So it's about non-harming. Yeah. And there could be ramifications within the family, but that's something you might have to deal with. But, you know, people can live together and have honest relationships, or be married and have dishonest relationships. You know, it's not a piece of paper doesn't mean too much. So, you know, if you are in a relationship that you consider both people consider monogamous, I can't say the word monogamous, and you've both made in a sense a commitment to that, then that to me is that marriage situation. Whether you have a ring on your finger or not, I think doesn't matter. However, if you've made that commitment, in a sense that vow, verbally understood or whatever, and you break it, then you're breaking that commitment. And that's far more important than whether you've been to a registry office and someone said, sign here. You know? That taboo has really come through the Judeo-Christian kind of ethic, really. Where, you know, you won't go to heaven if you're not married, which just seems ridiculous. You know? And I think a lot of Christians don't buy into that now either. But it was very much in the past. Terrible. Look, it was in the 1930s in Australia, it was absolutely almost a taboo for a younger woman, a younger man to go out with an older woman. It was considered absolutely appalling, a total immorality in the 1930s in Australia. Yeah, terrible. How could a younger man go out with an older woman? That's immoral. Yeah, just ridiculous. So we have these taboos which are often not based on logic or clarity, and this is why if you have this template of is this harming, is this creating negativity, that can be your template. So there's no black and white, you know. There may be a situation where there's some very strict parents and in a relationship, and the daughter or son, that may be a problem. Then you have to start lying to the parents. That could be a difficulty. Do you see what I mean? And that might cause a lot of upset. Difficult there. How do you get around that? Maybe then you get married instead, you know. But then, you know, you may not be ready for marriage. And it may be a disaster. So those areas you can only... Again, that's what I say at the coalface. You can't make a decision until you're actually there. Now, that becomes a hypothetical and you don't know. But according to Buddhism, there's not that rule. And, you know, in various countries around the world, there'll be different levels of marriage too. You know? So which one do you pick? But a good point. Yes? Can it be recycled? And it can be recycled again? Well, there's your ethical problem with the throwing out. That's one way of looking at it. The person that ordered it did it. Why? Why did they do it without your consent? I think you have to run this straight down the line. You know why? Because the person that did it without checking needs to learn. I think so. I don't think you'll lose. He won't lose his job over that. I think you just, yeah. Look, interestingly enough, okay, this maybe help you with the answer. One guy I knew who was a student of my teacher, he was in a big accounting firm, and my teacher said to him, the moment you make any mistake, even a small one, go to your boss and tell him. He went, what? He said, yep. And because of his guru said that, he went, oh, okay. So he said, even a minor mistake, you go to your boss and you admit that you've made a mistake. And there was a couple of other things you had to do too, but yeah, it's a bit embarrassing. He said, what, even a minor mistake? He said, yep, don't you cover up a thing. You go straight to your boss and tell him. And a year later, 25% of that office were retrenched and he got a promotion. You know? So I think you have to actually bite the bullet, as sad as it is. You have to actually act ethically with it on all levels, and I think you have to go and say to this guy, look, I'm really sorry, we're going to have to go to the boss and tell him what happened. You know? And I would doubt whether he'll lose his job, unless he's done a lot of other things in the same way. And if he's a serial offender, he needs to lose his job so that he can learn from it. Okay. Well, then he he needs to learn, and you can say that to him.
Yeah.
You know, sit down with him and say, look, this is the second time this has happened. We're going to have to go to the boss and tell him what's happened. I'm really sorry. It's not about harming. You're not about harming him. But if he goes, is he a young guy?
Yeah.
He's got to learn now, because if he doesn't learn now, when he makes a big mistake that causes some real problem.
Like
a thousand copies
or something, that would be.
Hello?
Yeah.
Let him learn on 50 copies and naughty, naughty. It's not going to destroy him, but he'll remember it really well. No, I think you have to go straight ahead with this right down the line. And if you don't, you're lying for him.
Mm-hmm.
And if you lie for him and the boss finds out, bigger problem.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to take him in hand and say, come on, we have to go and tell the boss this one. Say, look, I'm really sorry, there was a misunderstanding. You don't have to put him in, so there's a misunderstanding. Unfortunately, Fred ordered this without me having to check it, and I didn't want him to check it, but there's been a misunderstanding. We're going to have to scrap these and do it again. Yeah. That's the problem in life. It ain't easy. This is called samsara. It doesn't work out perfectly, but we have to do the best we can with what we've got. Yeah, that's all. So yeah, that's a difficult one. But you're not out to harm him, but you also can't cover up his mistakes, because if you cover that one up, he's not going to learn a thing. He'll do it again. And how old is he? You know? Yeah. And he's not listening. Well, he needs to listen. And so, look, this is with all of us. It's only when we bump into a brick wall that we find out that it's hard. Up until that point, it's only conjecture. So he'll work out about writing things down. You know, when he does it, I'll tell you a story that happened to me with it. When I first got to Sydney, and this is going right back into the early 80s, I had a massage business. I was doing house calls to do massage, which I still do to this day. And I had this client. And I only had one other client, and I was building my business from word of mouth. And this client said to me, I gave him a massage. He's a very wealthy businessman, very powerful businessman. And he said, look, that was great. He said, can you come at Monday at 9:30? I went, yeah, great. I've got another massage. Fabulous. I eat. So I'm sitting in a coffee shop on Monday at about 10 o'clock going, something. Oh no! The client completely had forgotten about it. Hadn't written it down, same deal. Hadn't written it down, forgot about it. Oh, how embarrassing. So I rang his office, and his daughter was on the reception, who I'd met the day before or something. Yeah, she knew me. She said, Daddy's furious with you. He waited till 10:15 and he's just livid. You didn't ring, you didn't turn up. What did you do? I said, I forgot. He said, oh, she said, don't tell him that. Tell him your car broke down. I said, no. She said, oh, you're crazy. She said, I'll put you through. Hello? Who's that? I said, it's Rod Lee. Yes? Said, look, I'm really sorry. I completely forgot. What? I forgot. And there's just this dead silence. He was like digesting. He forgot. I said, yeah, I didn't write it down. I completely forgot. Well, can you come tomorrow? I said, absolutely. I'll see you then. Now, think about it, if I had have said, oh, my car broke down. Oh, yes. And what time was that? Oh, 9:30. Oh, yeah. Well, did you ring the NRMA? Yeah, well, why didn't you ring me? You know,
yeah.
It's ridiculous. You know? And then, do you think he would have employed me? No way. I'm lying to him straight off. There's the business relationship just destroyed. Relationship finished. Gone. By squirming out of it. And there was his daughter saying, and I guess she probably lied to him a lot. You know? But then it's his father, so there's probably a lot of forgiveness there and a bit of give and take. But as an employer, as I was at that stage, and he was a client of mine for years. And you know what? I never forgot again. He never had that problem with me ever again. I absolutely nailed every time he made an appointment, I wrote it down and I got there. So, okay, that'll do us. Thank you very much once again. It's always a joy to see you all, and see you next time.